Welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast, where business leaders come to share their advice and journeys to success with existing and emerging leaders of America. Join us as we delve into the minds of these accomplished individuals, uncovering the strategies and insights that have propelled them to the top. Whether you're an established leader or an emerging force in the business world, this podcast is your go-to source for the knowledge and inspiration needed to navigate the dynamic landscape of American business. Now, here's your host, Dylan Bloyd.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast. Our guest today is none other than Terry Jones. Terry is a seasoned entrepreneur, renowned speaker, and author, known for his innovative contributions to the travel industry and the intersection of technology and business. As the founder of Travelocity, Terry played a pivotal role in revolutionizing the way we plan and book our travel adventures online. Following his success at Travelocity, Terry co-founded Kayak.com, another trailblazing online travel agency known for its innovative use of technology. Today, he brings his wealth of experience and insights to audiences around the world as a speaker and author of On Innovation and Disruption Off. In this episode, we'll delve into Terry's journey from the early days of shaping the online travel landscape to his current role as a thought leader. We'll explore the challenges of triumphs of leading pioneer companies, the dynamic world of entrepreneurship, and gain insights into the future of business and technology. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Can you please go a bit further on your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. It's a little bit of a long story because I've had a long career, but I grew up in Chicago and I went to school at Denison University in Ohio. I majored in history. I thought I was going to go to Vietnam. I had a very low draft number, but was rejected because of my eyes. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And one of my roommates' dad was a pilot for Transworld Airlines. He said, I have a free pass and I'm going to use that to go around the world before I go get to my PhD and lose it. So three of us spent a year going around the world. I came back and said, I want to get into this travel thing. Mm-hmm. So I went to travel school at night. My dad was not thrilled. He paid for a college education, but I became a travel agent. 6 months in, my manager said, let's go do a startup. So I left. We did a startup that over 5 years, we turned into the 50th largest travel company in the U.S. So that was fun. But yeah. Then I got interested in computing. So I jumped to a company that sold computers to travel agents. They were accounting and ticketing computers. 6 months in, we sold that to American Airlines. So suddenly I'm in this big company and I moved. I was in marketing. They moved me to IT. I had 500 programmers. They moved me to operations. I ran computer operations. That's when I lost my hair. I had several thousand people, about a $300 million budget, 50,000 computer terminals around the world. And then I became CIO of American Airlines and Sabre. And while I was CIO, one of the little products we had was an online product called Easy Sabre. And the travel agents had woken up to that. And they said, you're selling bullets to the enemy there. That thing could be big. You should turn it off. And our chairman was smart enough to say, no, we're not going to turn it off, but I'll give it to Jones over in IT. We'll hide it over there.
Yeah.
And the first thing I said, this was 1996, why isn't it on the internet? Internet had just been deregulated. So we put it on the internet and it grew like a weed in the spring. And pretty soon I said, I don't want to be CIO anymore. I want to go do that. And people said, you're kind of crazy. There's only 10 people there. I said, no, I think it could be big. And over the next 5 years, it grew to $3 billion in travel sales. We took it public, ran it as a public company. And then they took it private. They wanted it back. And when they took it back, I decided I didn't want to do that. I thought they would screw it up, which they did.
Right.
So I left and became a speaker and an author, started joining corporate boards, and was working at a venture capital firm when we got the idea for Kayak. And so I was chairman there for 8 years. We took it public and sold it to Priceline for $1.8 billion. So that was a terrific exit. Then I did an AI company for 5 years in travel, and that eventually failed. We can talk about AI a bit if we have time. And then since then, I've really been a board member, an advisor, and a speaker. And today I'm advising three ChatGPT-based AI travel companies on the board of one and advising others. So still speaking and writing and having a lot of fun.
What an inspiration. That is incredible to hear all that. I did want to backtrack back to Travelocity a little bit. So when you were with Travelocity, how did you approach building and leading the teams in the early days at Travelocity?
Well, it's a really good question. And in my book on innovation, I talk about it and in my speeches because it was intrapreneurship. This was a startup inside American Airlines. So that's very different than a Silicon Valley startup. We had money. We had desks. We had offices. But we also had bureaucracy. You know, I had to use their purchasing department, their IT department, their legal department. They didn't understand consumers. They were a B2B company. So one of the things we did was I moved us out of headquarters. So we were in a little strip mall. We could build our own culture. I got all these people from other departments, and finally the company let me mold them together into a team where they actually work for Travelocity. I told HR I want to hire a lot of people from outside the company. They said, you can't do that. You have to hire inside first. I said, I already got those guys.
Yeah.
I want different guys and gals. And that took about 6 months. So we brought in people from Microsoft, from other online companies. So we had, you know, a lot of young people who thought the travel was broken, they could fix it on one side. On the other side, we had the suits, you know, the corporate types who said travel isn't broken. They were slow paced, but they knew travel. Mm-hmm. You put them together, they fought like cats in a bag. But that's the kind of crucible that creates a great company. You want debate. Now, once you've debated, you want to move forward, you know, toward the goal. But you need that kind of culture clash, I think, to foster collaboration over time and to keep you, you know, focused on the goal and what's new. So really by separating out of the corporate structure, by creating teams of inside and outside people, by having a budget that was held at the very top of the corporation, because everybody wanted our money. Mm-hmm. We were losing money. They were making money. But we had to lose money. And then, you know, eventually when we took it public, that was $1.2 billion for the shareholders. So they got their return back.
Right. Oh, yeah. You're right about that. I mean, this was some groundbreaking stuff, being the first online travel agency. Did you receive a bunch of pushback from people who would rather just book travel the old-fashioned way? Did it take a while to build that up, or did people really
gravitate? Well, you know, actually, we got a tremendous amount of usage fairly early. It surprised Wall Street. When we went public, they were all off looking at e-toys and warehousing companies and other stuff. But travel ended up being the largest part of e-commerce. It's larger than books, electronics, and fashion combined. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, people wouldn't always book. They were afraid of putting their credit card online, for example. That wasn't a thing that people were used to doing. So we put an 800 number up and said, if you want to give us your information that way, you can. We didn't tell them, of course, we put their credit card in online.
Right, yeah.
When they called us. Yeah. But, you know, it made them feel better. We had to have price guarantees that we had the lowest price. Still, you know, a lot more people were looking than booking in the early days. So we did lots of things to convince them. We had membership programs that they got bonuses. We could track the fare to grandma's house and tell them when the fare went down. We invented paging you when your flight was late. Nobody had done that. And it was paging. That's how long ago this was.
Right.
Eventually it came through texting.
Right.
So it took a while, but it actually grew faster than anybody ever imagined.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that. That is such a cool story. To be the first travel agency is just absolutely crazy. So from 96 to 2004, there was actually quite a few agencies that were developed, right?
Sure.
So Kodak.
Expedia came out of Microsoft. We came out of American Airlines. Priceline was an actual startup mm-hmm. where you would bid for things. So they were kind of the big three, and there were some others. The traditional brands, the airlines and hotels, were very slow to get online. Mm-hmm. I actually ran the American Airlines website, the US Air website, the American Express website. I mean, they outsourced to me, which is crazy.
Yeah.
They eventually figured out that was stupid and did it themselves. So it took time for others to get there. And then, of course, the airlines got together and formed a project internally called Travelocity Terminator that became Orbitz. Orbitz was four airlines together giving themselves their own website with the lowest price. I bitterly complained to the government, even talked to the president of the United States, President Clinton at the time, But they said, oh, it's just airlines. It's not antitrust. Well, it was antitrust. But anyway, they came along. And so we had lots of competition. And that was good because it was a growing market. Mm-hmm. So that's okay.
Right. So in 2004, that's kind of when Kayak entered the market, right? So mm-hmm. how did you lead Kayak to differentiate itself and compete effectively?
Well, I was chairman. So first of all, we hired some terrific guys, Steve Hafner and Paul English, who ran the business. But the concept was really different. The concept was, you know, we got together at a dinner and said, only 5% of our arrivals are actually buying tickets. So 95% of the people are not. If Walmart had a back door as big as their front door and everybody left without anything, their stock would crash. But in e-commerce, it's kind of normal. Mm-hmm. So we said, what else could we do? We said, well, why don't we build vertical search for travel? That was the idea of Kayak. Search everywhere, but when you click, you buy direct. And we presented that idea to some airlines. We said, look, our clicks convert at a much higher rate. Google drops you at the homepage. Our customers are already shopped. We drop you at the last page. Just put in the credit card and they'll convert. And we proved that. But the airline said, you know, we don't want to create another competitor. We're not going to pay you. So luckily, we were VC backed. And the VC said, build it anyway. We gave airlines, and some airlines paid, and we were getting paid for hotels, but many didn't. We built a tremendous amount of traffic. And then one day we turned it off. Hmm. And the airlines called and said, where did the traffic go? And we said, same place your money did. Dude, nowhere. And so then they paid. So I guess we invented ransomware, but it you know, sometimes there's a great quote that said, the game is over if the startup gets the distribution before the incumbent gets the innovation. Hmm. And that's what happened here. We got the distribution. So, you know, we had enough market power that we could charge. Kayak was, Paul English, our CTO, was the best hiring manager I've ever seen. He would go anywhere in the world to hire an engineer and convince them to come, not based on money, but based on the fact that they were going to be on the World Series team. Mm-hmm. They were going to be with other amazing engineers who were going to build something that would change everything. And then the last question he asked was, who's the smartest person you know? And he would go interview that person. So we had a terrific team. We actually went public with only 200 people. Very, very small at the time. It was a simple business that we focused entirely on the customer and the UI. Mm-hmm. It's a radically different UI than any other travel site, way faster, much easier to use. And we wanted mobile as well. We had 60 million mobile customers who downloaded the app. So very, very successful with a kind of a new way of looking at travel.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Just took off and just massive success.
Well, a lot
obviously,
of work.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're right about that. And obviously, the company's done a ton of innovating, Travelocity as well, because obviously they're still very, very relevant today, especially with all the competition, how fast everything is evolving. But when you were in there, what leadership strategies did you employ to guide Kayak through those competitive landscapes?
Well, I think it was interesting. Much of what we learned at Travelocity was maybe no longer useful. Hmm. Search had become huge. Whereas when Travelocity started, search wasn't big. Mm-hmm. We were buying banner ads. We were advertising in the newspaper. Kayak was totally search-based. And in those days, the terms were cheap enough so we could arbitrage between what we paid for the search and what we earned in commission. So, you know, we, as the board, you know, we really encouraged search. We encouraged them to move internationally. We told them how we thought they had to do it. They didn't do it that way. They failed and they tried again. The board also pushed them, before we went public, actually, to advertise traditionally in television and radio because they were competing against people who were spending billions of dollars on brand, Expedia and Priceline, Booking.com. They didn't want to do that, but they did, and it certainly helped us as we went public. So I think we had a great board with people who took a long view. We actually filed for our IPO and then the market went off and we couldn't go public. And there were all these articles about Kayak stuck on the runway, Kayak engine failure, that kind of stuff. But the board had the courage to wait. And eventually Booking.com wanted to buy us. We couldn't agree on a price. So we went public and then there isn't any argument about price. You're just public.
Right. Yeah.
They have to pay a premium. So I think I think taking a long view with that kind of startup, and, you know, it was 8 years before we went public, and companies are taking longer than that today to go public. And in the meantime, you know, Steve and Paul just focused on the customer like crazy, built a terrific brand. And on the one side with, you know, our management team, and on the other side, Paul focused on an incredibly responsive and super fast UI. And really building an A player team and not being reticent to cut people who weren't making it. Because, you know, if you're building a World Series team, some people have to go down to the farm club. You know, just they can't cut it. And sometimes in big companies, that's really hard. You know, you don't move people out who aren't cutting it. It's harder in big companies. Small companies, you just have to do it. Yeah. And we had a super small team.
Right. Yeah, those big companies, they need the best of the best if they want to stay on the top. So yep. It completely makes sense. Do you still advise on any of those boards for Travelocity, Kayak, or American Airlines?
No, I got fired when they didn't need another chairman of the board. Still good friends with those guys. Yeah. But I do an awful lot of startup work. So today, although I've been on 19 boards, today I do much more advisory board work. And just get with a company and like these GPT startups that I'm working with. I joined one new board recently, which is a fascinating company that is using natural language to automate business travel bookings. So what you can do is send an email and say, I want to go to New York tomorrow, stay at the Hilton, come back Friday. And we'll come back with three travel options that are conformant to travel, your company's travel policy, conform to your personalization, right? And you look at them and say, yeah, that's what I want. Wow. And it's so much easier than mucking around for, you know, 30 minutes online with, frankly, a lot of user interfaces that haven't changed since I designed Travelocity.
Right.
So there are tons of interesting AI use cases now in the travel space.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting. So I was just thinking, is it basically similar to ChatGPT where you can say, find me something cheaper, find me something that's two stops, and just engage with that?
Yeah, whatever you want to say in the email, but it's not a chat today.
Oh, okay.
Because we found this asynchronous, hey, I can send an email, boom, and then I get some answers. That, you know, once you trust it, that it knows you and it knows where the company says, you know, you have to fly in United, you have to stay at Marriott, whatever it is, then it's like, yeah, okay, it's done.
Right.
And so that's interesting for people. We're going to build it soon into things like Slack and texting and other ways of doing those kind of bookings. But GPT, I'm advising another company who actually build a database of routes because they interviewed 2,000 guides and then add GPT to it. So this is like, I want to go from Paris to Milan in 7 days. What should I do? GPT's okay at that. This site called Route Perfect is way better than that because we have private data mixed with public data. Mm-hmm. And you can press a button and book the hotel and book the tour to the Vatican or whatever you want to do. And GPT can't do that yet.
Right.
So a lot of fun stuff going on there.
Yeah. It's almost like niche markets for these are already developing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's using AI to the most exciting, you know, I had this AI company for 6 years and one of the IBM guys I worked with said, you know, the most exciting AI solutions will take public data like GPT, industry data, which might be from a trade association, and then corporate data, which is private. And you mix that together in a new recipe and you create new products. That's what Route Perfect is doing. They have this wonderful data from 2,000 guides that nobody else has.
Right.
And GPT doesn't have it either. And you mix that together with the GPT data in a new recipe and you see if you got a tasty dish or not.
That is really, really cool. I'm excited to see it continue to develop. So you mentioned you've been on 19 corporate boards. You've also presented to 300 plus companies in 25 countries and wrote the book Disruption Off that provides people with tools and technologies in order to stay competitive in an aggressive, hyper-connected economy. Can you give us a few examples of tools and technologies that you provide in your book? And are these tools and technologies constantly evolving with the, you know, rapid advancement of technology?
Well, I think the technologies are advancing. The tools may stay the same. So Disruption Off starts with maybe 20 different technologies that are disrupting business. and showing people how they're disrupting business. And hopefully they can connect the dots and saying, wow, that's how the oil industry is using drones. How could we apply them in our business? I just spoke to the National Dairy Association, and actually dairy cow farmers are extremely advanced. They're using robotic milkers. They're using drones to detect disease in cattle. But most of that first part of the book is to just scare the heck out of people about how fast change is coming. And then you move into what should I do about it? The first thing I talk about is take more risk. You know, larger companies, every company was started by a risk taker, but risk gets driven out by operational efficiency. So we get very good, our delivery muscle gets very strong, and our discovery muscle is kind of weak. And we have to take risks, and we have to fail if we're going to move forward. I mean, 80% of startups fail. But in corporations, every idea has to be a success. Well, that's baloney. Yeah. That can't happen. So you don't have to bet the farm on a new idea. I mean, you can do a 3D printed prototype. You can do an online web test. You can use AI to simulate what might happen. But you have to try. And when you fail, you have to kill projects, not people. Because, you know, so many times we blame Dylan, you know, for doing the wrong thing. And then Dylan's career goes down. No, it probably was a good idea. Dylan probably tried hard. Well, it might have been a good idea.
Yeah.
Dylan tried hard, but maybe the customers just weren't ready for it. Maybe it was too soon. Or maybe it was a bad idea, a wonderfully executed bad idea.
Yeah.
So what do we learn, right? And you have to make faster decisions. Corporations have what I call the corporate pinball machine. So you launch an idea out there and marketing says, well, that's a stupid idea. And customer service said, don't worry, we couldn't support it. If you get through them and manufacturing says they can't build it, right? If you get through them, they bring out the big guns, finance and legal. They always say no.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't do that. You have to, in the 21st century, you have to say yes. Yes, how can I help get this new idea over the finish line? Don't say no and go back to doing email.
Right.
And then, you know, a lot of big corporations will look at a startup. I actually, my LinkedIn post today is about that. And they'll say, how can they do that? How can they do that? Instead of saying, how can we do that? Because guess what? You have the assets, the factory, the supply chain, the people, the brand, everything a startup would kill for. You just can't get out of your own way.
Yeah.
And there's more. If we have more time, I'd be happy to do more. But
right. No, well, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that. And that gives the listeners an idea of what that book's about. And then,
yeah, there's a bunch more ideas. It's 72 3-page chapters. It's very snackable.
Yeah.
You can read it front to back or back to front. It's more like a cookbook.
Yeah.
So most business books are, you know, 3 good ideas and a lot of hamburger helper in the middle.
You're right.
And I tried to write a shorter book that's a little more pithy.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to pick it up myself. So thank you for that. You mentioned LinkedIn. Is there other ways that listeners can connect with you, or is LinkedIn the way?
Yeah, sure. I mean, LinkedIn is there. My website is terryjones.com. Took me a long time to buy that. Terry Jones being the guy in Monty Python.
Right.
But I finally got that. So it's terryjones.com. And there are lots of videos they can watch of speeches. You can buy books there and learn more about what I do.
Perfect. All right. That's terryjones.com, right?
Yep.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I do have one more question before we go. What advice would you give to emerging and existing leaders who are looking to either become leaders or become better leaders within their organizations?
Well, you know, I think it's important to understand that one person can make a difference. You can make a difference. Think of the difference Satya Nadella has made at Microsoft. It's gone from 300 billion market cap to 2 trillion, or Alan Mulally at Ford, or, you know, you can name dozens of people. And we all know that it doesn't have to be the CEO. We all know the leader who came in, looked at the group and the team and the problem in a new way, and really listened. The best ideas come from the bottom. The person in customer service, the engineer, the salesperson out front. Listen to them and understand your job is to get barriers out of their way. If they have a new idea, how can I move the world so that they can be successful? If they're successful, you can be successful. But your job as a leader is to superpower their behavior. You know, to add XP 29 to the gas tank or whatever it is, so that those people can flourish. That's your job. You have to paint the vision for them of where you want to go, and then get out of the way and help them. Right? Don't try. The hardest thing for a manager to do is to say, "I could do it better than them." Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you could, but you're not supposed to. You know, you have to delegate and empower them to be successful.